This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello there. You're listening to The Morning Run on BFM 89.9, the business station. Good morning. I'm Melissa Idris and I've got Sharad Kutin here with me.
Good morning.
Hello. We were just talking about how we read the news that Samantha Schubert has passed away, actress and producer, former Miss World, former Miss Malaysia, Miss World 1991, and a successful model, and has passed away at the young age of 47 years.
I think for many of us from a particular generation would remember her, and she was a personality. But I think in recent times, she's been less and less active in the public eye.
Mm-hmm.
Though, you know, just looking quickly at the Star obituary of her, she did act in several movies. Even up to 2006, she was in a movie called Red Kabaya. And actress Tiara Jacquelina, you know, notes that she was a member of something called the Kit Kat Club.
Okay, well,
sure, but I don't know what year that was.
Well, apparently she was being treated for cancer.
That's right.
That must have been a long-standing
disease. So she's died at a very young age of, you know, 47.
Very young. Okay, our condolences to her friends and family. But we also, you know, as always, life goes on. We continue on with the show today. 4 hours, we're gonna bring you lots of news and analysis, interviews as well. And Sharad, you're going to be speaking to George Yeo, former Minister of Foreign Affairs for Singapore, on the Breakfast Grill today.
Yeah, he's a long list of accomplishments. You know, minister in various ministries, including culture, and you know, growing up in Singapore, I remember him as one of those ministers given to kind of a philosophical turn, and would you know, talk through many of the issues that Singapore was going through in sort of in less than pragmatic terms. I mean, there was the pragmatism that marks the PAP, but he was maybe on the philosophical end of that pragmatic party, or that uber pragmatic party. He, of course, lost in a general election two general elections ago, when the opposition in Singapore made some quite stunning gains, especially in something called the group representation constituency, which are these super constituencies. Some say designed to thwart any real progress for the opposition in Singapore, and they lost. So that was big. And sometimes what happens with these group constituencies is they put a big hitter. They put somebody, a proven cabinet minister, whatever, and then they put all these new faces with him. So that cabinet minister carries with him or her the others, the underlings, the newbies, as it were. And unfortunately, it was a strategy that did not work in Giorgio's case. But he's gone on to do some very interesting things, including being chancellor of something called the Nalanda University, which is an initiative to revive an ancient university. This is a Buddhist university from many, many centuries ago. Some claim the first university in the world. And so he succeeded Amartya Sen, the Nobel laureate for economics, in that position. There was some controversy around it, but interesting, because Singapore has put lots of money, the Singapore government itself has put lots of money behind the Nalanda project, which is a kind of transnational project for education.
Wow. Okay, so we'll be speaking to him all about his insights into policy making in Singapore, also his new role in academia. Lots to discuss on the Breakfast Grill today. George Yeo, former Minister of Foreign Affairs for Singapore. We also continue our look at the Sarawak nominations. Yes, as it happened yesterday. Today on Current Affairs, you're going to be speaking to YB Chung Chen Jen, Sarawak DAP chairman.
Yeah, so we spoke yesterday to Peter Minos from the PBB, which is the main party in the ruling Barisan National Coalition, about many of the issues that are came up for contention in this election, including the delimitation exercise. We asked him if it gave...
he was very candid.
He was very candid. You know, we asked him if it gave PBB and Barisan National an unfair advantage. You know, he took all those questions on his chin and I think put forward the Barisan National case. Today we're going to be looking at one of the major contenders in urban Sarawak. The DAP has many seats in urban Sarawak. They, of course, have come into this election election, recognizing that Adnan Satim as the new chief minister is hugely popular and that it might in fact erode their hold on Urban Sarawak. Mm. What's interesting about Urban Sarawak, and we were speaking to Peter Minos, was that in fact people in Urban Sarawak, very much like people in urban peninsula Malaysia, are concerned about larger issues like 1MDB and such, and they're animated by those discussions, less so with the question of the provision of basic infrastructure and amenities. Whereas, you know...
Well, because they already have...
They already have it. And so this is, all, of course, always a question about rural development. You know, mm-hmm. in fact, in many ways, you can hold on to your vote bank to the extent that you keep your rural population needing these things and sort of giving, passing them out, you know, in piecemeal mm-hmm. fashion. So would the politics of rural Sarawak or, in fact, rural Peninsula Malaysia be any different if the populations there were somehow liberated from the need for some basic infrastructure and, you know, were kind of on par with right. urban Malaysia in terms of their outlook. So, well, interesting questions, I think.
Well, I also think it's interesting, you know, DAP, looking at DAP and the fact that there are many, you know, kind of overlap seats that they're contesting between with PKR as well. In fact, DAP Secretary General Lim Guan Eng, he was very upset yesterday after the nominations. He said he felt shortchanged because, you know, there were contests between PKR and DAP, and which he claims will create confusion among voters because, you know, the parties should be fighting from the same side.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, these are the realities in any democracy. I mean, just look at what's happening in the US, what's happened in Australia with the changing prime ministers. Democracies and democratic parties do not operate like, you know, like Stalinist parties. I mean, they often reflect a variety of orientations, even under one tent, mm-hmm. you know. And of course, personalities become the organizing principle
but
of these differences.
Don't you think that that could backfire for the good of the, you know, the overall good for the part of the coalition?
Right? Of course it could. But, you know, but that's the nature of the democratic game. I mean, I don't think anybody who is a supporter or advocate of democracy as a system of governance should be naive about how messy it is. It's not the most perfect system. It right. clearly is, as many, I think, much more kind of mature supporters note, it is the best system out of many choices. Many of them just worse, you know. So you could use totalitarianism or you can have some soft authoritarianism.
It's the lesser of all evils, okay.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the way I put it. That's exactly the phrase I should be, yeah.
36 seats will see straight fights between Barisan Nasional and Pakatan Harapan candidates. So there'll also be many multi-cornered fights in 42 of the 82 seats. And BN has won 2 seats uncontested for the polls. After nomination day yesterday. So we'll keep you abreast with any developments. In fact, we'll be speaking to the DAP, Sarawak DAP chairman, YB Chong Cheng Jen, on Current Affairs Day, 8:35 a.m. for an update from Sarawak. And also happening today is the BBC World Service on the Morning Run. That's at 9:35 a.m. And the BBC commemorates the death anniversary of William Shakespeare. It's been 400 years. And by looking at the impact the Bard has had on the business world. Now, if you look in Bollywood, Shakespeare's stories have been major money spinners in Indian cinema, thanks to movies like Omkara, which is a take on Othello, and Haider, which is based on Hamlet. Meanwhile, in China, Shakespeare's works are being marketed to a new generation of domestic consumers, all eager for a taste of historical culture. So today, BBC's author and critic Andrew Dixon travels around the world to find out how Shakespeare is still very much in business. In fact, he discovers that the Bard is one of the most successful and flexible cultural brands in the world. So that's on BBC, the BBC World Service on the Morning Run at 9:35 a.m. It's now 10 minutes past 6. Let's take a quick look at the news and what happened late last night. In the US, Ted Cruz and John Kasich are teaming up to in an effort to deny Donald Trump the Republican presidential nomination, each agreeing to stand aside in certain states so the other can win if the other has a lead. This is all in a bid to block Trump. Will they succeed? Can this tag team succeed?
Okay, so what is that actually, I think, is happening, as I understand it, is that by not stepping down entirely, right, one for the other, they're basically trying to play the delegates game. And so when it comes to the delegate count, that Trump will go into the convention without the adequate delegate count, mm-hmm. The minimum that he would need, that would force basically the Republican convention to declare him the nominee. So a contested a contest will happen at the Republican convention. I think that's, as I understand, that's what the game plan, the end game for this plan is.
I actually don't know whether this will succeed, but it really does send an important signal that they're willing to put aside whatever, you know, competition to, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, right? So
The complexity of the American system.
We just talked about the Malaysian system.
There and you know, the American system is very complex because of this, the character of these delegates. You have differences between caucuses and primaries. Mm-hmm. Primaries referring, looking much more like a pure vote, a straight vote, whereas caucuses are discussions and they have their own dynamics. And then you have these delegates and you have these super delegates and then you have delegates that have to vote for their state, if the, you know, but in a second round they can, then they are free to vote. So there's this whole dynamic of pushing it to the second vote in order to free delegates from actually having being compelled to vote the way their state voted. So there are all these complexities, but they're only about the political party. This is not even the big game yet, which is the presidential election. So all these things, I think, add to the drama that is American politics. Mm. Of course, made big for everybody, and put in everybody's living room through the media.
And I'm surprised that there's no. I mean, this has been one of the longest, campaigning seasons for any U.S. presidential race. I'm surprised there's not been fatigue at this. We still have some ways to go. I mean, till November, where you're actually till polling day in November. So it's been a long journey, and I think that, you know, I am surprised that we're not fatigued by it. Even
you
I can imagine
non-Americans.
Non-Americans, yeah.
Well,
I'm sure Americans could be.
Participation rate of Americans in their own democratic process?
Voting patterns, you mean the percentage for voter turnout?
Yeah. I mean, how many people actually vote in elections in America? And I think it's less than 50%. So you have a population that is already structurally fatigued. I mean, you know, the levels of voting are quite low already. And then there's voting that happens, you know, throughout. It's not just that they vote once every 4 years.
About 57% was the last count.
Right. So if you think 57%, any winners going into the White House with less than maybe a quarter of the voting population's, thumbs up. And so So what does it say about American democracy? And because, see, this is a problem in many mature democracies, participation rates fall often. But again, that's the nature of things, partly because I think the contestants all start to resemble each other.
Well, closer to home, back home, in fact, news here that the Sultan of Terengganu, Sultan Mirza Zainal Abidin, has stripped Menteri Besar Ahmad Razif of all the titles bestowed on him. So the statement from the Royal House reads, "This declaration has no connection with other developments in Terengganu."
Okay, so we know it's happened. There was speculation about whether it happened. Now we know it happened. The question is why, and I don't know the statement actually includes
I reading the statement from news reports doesn't actually say why, and I wasn't able to find out the reasons why one a ruler revokes a title bestowed upon someone. Well, I'm sure there are reasons for, but you know, it's not listed.
Do anyway. They have to give it, in fact?
Whether they have to declare it. Yeah,
yeah, I think, you know, I mean, we could be glad that we don't have the politics that we see in other countries, including Bangladesh. Have you been reading about what's happened in Bangladesh? We had this professor of English being murdered.
Hacked to death.
And now you have a editor of a gay rights magazine and his friend also hacked to death. Apparently, they're all part of Bangladesh ISIL or ISIS in Bangladesh that's been carrying out attacks against bloggers, often individuals who've been advocating a secular state for Bangladesh, people who have been advocating rationalism and science. Mm. They are all been subject to these attacks. There have been now, you know, half a dozen or more murders of Bangladeshi intellectuals and bloggers by these Islamic militants.
Wow.
Interesting, because we just had an attack at a temple in Ipoh, and I think the IGP has come out to say that this was, in fact, an individual who was declared mentally unsound. He was a doctor.
Bipolar was the term that I saw.
Yeah. Yeah, but in the Star report, it also notes that he had black flags in his car, was suggesting that, you know, he might have, in his mental instability, might have been associating himself with ISIL or something. Because that's the trademark of the ISIL group,
the black flag. Mm.
Interesting how, and it might be that many mentally unstable people become attracted to militant organizations because of the kind of black and white view they have of the world. Who knows, right? But at any rate, I think the IGP and the police have been trying to calm tensions that have arisen because of this attack. I think the individual went into a Hindu temple and desecrated the statues there and so you have this temple desecration. But of course, we still haven't reached the level of Bangladesh where you know, intellectuals are being murdered because they don't conform to the values of a minority group.
The release of Game of Thrones premiere season 6 yesterday has gotten us talking about binge watching and our TV habits. So I don't know, Sherrod, are you a binge watcher? Could you do the one episode a week and then wait for the next week, or do you hoard all the episodes and watch it at once?
Having watched television for several decades now, when in fact,
had to wait.
Yeah, in the early 80s, you had no choice. I mean, you had to wait. I mean, there might have been an opportunity, I guess, to, you know, copy it to a VHS tape or something, and somebody might have saved it all for you, you know, and then you could have watched it all at once. But really, it wasn't really an option then. It was not a popular option anyway.
Okay. Well, now with the changing habits of media consumption, I mean, we all... you know, that we have options of streaming, or not just cable, but you know, on-demand viewing. And that changes the way we consume our TV. How do you consume yours?
Oh, well, okay. So I have become a binge watcher. So all I can say was I wasn't in the past, because perhaps I had no choice. And I like the idea, or at least I believed I liked the idea of, you know, deferred gratification. I would watch it, you know, one of my favorite shows actually at one point was something called Northern Exposure, which, you know...
What's that?
Northern Exposure, it's kind of a quirky... comedy drama set in Alaska, and you know, it came every week. But truth be told, there were also some television series that came every day, like Young and the Restless, which I watched while I was in secondary school in the early 80s. And I would come home, and there was always an episode to watch. I mean, because it happened on a daily basis. So even then, in those dark days when, you know, people had just emerged from the primordial slime, there was television that happened every day, like a TV drama that, you know, kind of unfolded. I don't know if it happened over the weekend though.
It could be daytime TV.
It would have been maybe just Monday to Fridays. But whatever it is, I have become somebody, because I don't watch television as such. I'm not watching it from television, though I do a bit of television.
So what does binge watching mean for you? I mean, how many hours are we talking about?
It means a wasted life.
Episodes.
It means brain death.
What are we talking about? Are we talking about like an entire season straight? Or are we talking about a few episodes?
Well, I mean, not an entire season.
Because
I mean,
that would be that like... That can be like an entire weekend in like a vortex, black hole of
what
just...
What about you? I mean, okay, so an American season would be 13 episodes, right?
Of typically, like a mini-series.
Of a mini-series. In Britain, I think it's usually 4. Because having just come out of House of Cards UK, which was 4, so that was easy because you got through the entire 3 seasons very quickly. I mean, in fact, the entire 3 seasons were just 12 episodes, whereas one season of House of Cards, the American version, is actually 13 episodes.
The reason I asked what your definition of binge watching is, because we all have different definitions. I thought I was a binge watcher only to have a conversation with a friend last week who binge watched the entire season of, I can't remember what it was he was watching, but it was 22 episodes of something, and he watched it all in one go. And I was surprised because my idea of binge watching was 3-4 episodes at the most. And I consider that a huge binge watch already.
Well, I think, you know, like binge drinking, the idea is that you
not
get...
Not that we're saying anything.
Well, just like the phenomena, whether, you know, you want to indulge in it or not, which is, I guess, your choice. A binge would be to eat, you know, to consume something both at an accelerated rate and perhaps in quantities that are unusual and extraordinary for, you know, so you're not taking your normal portion, you're taking double or triple. So I think it doesn't really matter whether it's an entire season. But the challenge is, of course, for some series that have gone on for several seasons now, to binge watch, to binge watch House of Cards, you're looking at 3 seasons.
3 seasons.
Whereas if you looked at Game of Thrones, which is what triggered
six,
this discussion,
six
it's already been 6 seasons. No, it's
coming into the six,
right?
Seasons.
So you have 5 seasons to get through if you haven't already and you want to catch up. I think the dilemma now is, Melissa, is this. It's going to be released, or it has been released. I don't know.
It has been released.
Is, right?
Yeah.
So do you want to wait for all the episodes to be released, or somebody will download it for you and give you all of them together? Or are you so anxious to find out if Jon Snow is dead or not?
No, spoilers. I haven't watched it.
Well, it's not a spoiler because I'm not going to, because I haven't
watched it
either.
Okay, all right.
But you need to catch the first episode now that it's come out.
Okay, and
especially
how much,
because people could be nasty.
That's right. So how much of that decision, making that decision, do you think about if someone would spoil it for you? Now, I have to say though that people can be really mean about spoilers. For instance, I remember people rushing to the cinema to watch Star Wars, right? The Force Awakens. And I was in earshot of someone who spoiled it for someone who was going to watch it that very weekend. And I remember thinking, oh, poor girl.
What was there to spoil?
That's a huge spoiler.
Was there?
There was.
I can't remember. I've actually seen the film. I don't think.
Yeah, Sharad.
No, okay. There were movies. I mean, I remember growing up, I remember growing up. What's that kind of odd, strange phase? But no, I mean, when I was growing up, the big spoiler movie was something called Kramer versus Kramer. Because at the end of this battle between parents over custody for their child, the question was, who got the child, right? So everybody was driving everybody else, at least in my little world, mad with this. Like, oh, you know, the father got the child or the mother got the child or whatever. And so that was my first introduction to the whole spoiler phenomenon.
Well, when I was growing up, my biggest spoiler was The Usual Suspects. And I remember someone spoiled it for me before I watched it.
The Usual Suspects. Was Kevin Spacey in
that? Yes, that's right. Kaiser Soze, right? So, I mean, the idea of the question of who is this Kaiser Soze was really kind of like, ooh, I really must watch this. And I remember someone spoiled it for me before I watched the movie. And I was very upset by that. It really detracted from my enjoyment. And I have to ask, at what point does a spoiler stop becoming a spoiler? We have to give it some kind of time frame, right? Can we talk about Kramer versus Kramer now after how many decades that movie has been, you know, showing?
Available. Yeah, I think there must be,
a cutoff point, right?
Yeah.
What about The Sixth Sense, for instance? You know, lots of people.
Or Macbeth. I mean, 400
oh, yeah,
years
go
later,
back to
I think
that.
You're allowed to say what happens in the end. You know, it's not. It becomes part of folklore.
But why do people enjoy spoiling it for others? I mean, why do spoilers exist? Why do people do
that? Why is there militancy and extremism? Why do people behead other people?
It's a big philosophical question in the morning.
Well, I think because I think it's partly driven by the nature of miniseries anyway, that they have these cliffhangers. So if you remember in the 80s, the big cliffhanger, because you don't remember it, was who shot J.R. Ewing. And this was because from the miniseries Dallas. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, it became, I don't know if this was a joke or whatever by the media, but they tried to make it a kind of global phenomenon. Everybody apparently around the world was watching Dallas, and there was this big cliffhanger. But, you know, recently watching a terrible series called Empire, what I noted was, like, every ad break, you know, just before every ad break, there seemed to be a cliffhanger. And so you kind of, the whole cliffhanger thing has become a bit of a farce because it's not used in a kind of judicious way. But that's partly the nature of serialized, kind of products like this. You want to have cliffhangers.
Well, Benjamin Cheung tweeted to say that he try binge watching Big Bang Theory. That's 104 hours across 9 seasons. I might try and do that, Benjamin, but I don't think I can. Thanks for your tweet. Next news, BFM 89.9.
The news on BFM 89.9.
Good morning. Here are the headlines. Dato' Sri Najib Razak will launch the 2015 National Transformation Programme Annual Report today. The report will address transformation in key socio-economic areas, which include strengthening the foundations for sustainable economic growth and improving public service delivery in the country. MIC Vice President Senator Dato' S. A. Vigneswaran will be sworn in as the 17th Dewan Negara President today, taking over from Tan Sri Abu Zahar Ujang, whose term has ended. According to The Sun, he plans to work closely with his Dewan Rakyat counterpart, Tan Sri Pandikar Amin Mulia, to make changes in Parliament Houses. Terengganu Menteri Besar Ahmad Razif Rahman has accepted the Terengganu Sultan's decision to strip him of his state awards and title, effective last Friday. He, however, pledged to continue to carry out his role as MB and prioritise the state's residents. The U.S. city of Cleveland has reached a $6 million settlement with a family of 12-year-old Tamir Rice, who was shot by police while holding a toy gun in 2014. Cleveland, however, does not admit any wrongdoing. And Canada has confirmed the death of one of its citizens held captive by Islamist militants for months in the Philippines. John Ridsdell was taken from a tourist resort along with three others by Abu Sayyaf last September. In the business headlines, Tan Sri Ismi Ismail is reportedly stepping down as Lembaga Tabung Haji's Group MD and CEO, a post he has held since 2006. According to The Edge, Ismi is set to be joining a government-linked company, likely to be Sime Darby Berhad, as its number two. Pahang Crown Prince Tunku Abdullah Ahmad Shah, and with parties acting in concert, have proposed a selective capital reduction to buy out the 39.8% stake of Tanah Makmur for 285 million ringgit or 1 ringgit 80 apiece. The parties plan to delist and privatise Tanah Makmur. Panasonic Holdings' third quarter net profits fell an annual 16% to 1.8 million ringgit due to the current adverse economic situation. Revenue fell 9% to 92 million. And Goldman Sachs has launched an online bank where customers can open an account for as little as $1. This comes after Goldman acquired GE Capital's online deposit platform, assuming about 16 billion of deposits from some 145,000 customers.
Market snapshot.
At the previous close in Asia, stocks fell amid caution ahead of monetary decisions from both the US Federal Reserve and the Bank of Japan later this week. Back home, the FBMK LCI closed 0.2% lower at 1,715 points. Overnight on Wall Street, the S&P 500 ended down 0.2% at 2,088 points. The Dow Jones was down 0.2% at 17,977 points. And the Nasdaq also settled down 0.2% at 4,896 points. In key commodities, spot gold is marginally lower at $1,237.65 per ounce, and Brent crude oil futures were last at $44.74 per barrel.
The Sporting Life.
Leicester City will win the Premier League if they beat Manchester United at Old Trafford on Sunday. This is after Tottenham could only draw 1-1 at home to West Brom this morning, leaving Spurs 7 points adrift of Leicester, with only 3 games left for both teams. Meanwhile, Juventus have won a 5th consecutive Serie A title after Napoli failed to beat Roma this morning. Napoli had to claim all 3 points to keep their hopes of catching Juve alive, but were defeated 1-0 at the Stadio Olimpico. Elsewhere, Verona stunned AC Milan 2-1 and Carpi edged Empoli 1-0. Rafael Nadal has begun legal proceedings against former French cabinet minister Roselyne Bachelot, who alleged that the Spaniard had failed a drug test. The 14-time Grand Slam champion denies ever having taken performance-enhancing substances. Meanwhile, at the Istanbul Cup, Adrian Mannarino was the most notable opening round casualty, going down in straight sets to Albert Ramos. And back home, national squash star Delia Arnold has made round two of the PSA Women's World Championships, but Lo Weeburn crashed out. The headlines and market news are brought to you from the resources of Bloomberg, Reuters and Bernama. I'm Nadia Aziz. You're now up to date on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Rendezvous in France with UEM Sunrise. Make dreams come true. Win Euro Cup 2016 tickets. Fully paid 5 days, 4 nights dream vacation to France. Choose from UEM Sunrise Signature Selection properties that come with irresistible deals in Cyberjaya, Montiara, Bangi and Iskandar Putri Johor. Stand to join the journey to European glory to support your dream team. Call 1-800-888-008 to find out more. Terms apply. Own your dream home. Watch your dream team with UEM Sunrise.
Ah, can't believe I'm in the Gold Coast streaming videos for free, playing online games for free, sharing photos to my jealous friends, also for free. With U-Mobile's data backpack, me and my member lines can roam with our postpaid data to 12 overseas destinations for free. Upgrade now to Malaysia's fastest mobile network. Ah, U-Mobile, where data hearts you.
Education is important, there's no doubt. But could music improve, say, your mathematics?
Music education has really positive ramifications in a person's development in whatever they choose to do. The skills that they develop, the complex motor skills that they develop, the coordination, all of that spills over into all other areas of their lives. And there are, you know, statistics that really support music education for excelling in education in general.
Listen to the rest of this interview with Dr. Jane Curry, Professor Donald Maurice and Emma Goodby here by searching for A Musical Kiwi Project in Tigerland on BFM.my.
Bold factual media. BFM 89.9.
Engaged to throw the road, rearrange.
BFM 89.9 REM there with Finest Work Song. Good morning, it's 6:41 a.m. on Tuesday, the 26th of April. I'm Melissa Idris with Sherrod Kutin here on The Morning Run. Now, would you be happy to have your tax return displayed for everyone to see? Well, in Norway, no one can disguise their earnings because every citizen's tax returns are made available for everyone else in the country to inspect. Workers can see what their colleagues earn, neighbors can snoop on how much the people next door make, all legally and all done online. What do you think, Sherrod? Would you mind if your tax return was made public?
I'm actually not sure. And I was, you know, reading the think piece in The Economist, which really kind of put the question out there, you know, is this really good policy? Because I think that in the democratic West, there is an equal importance placed on the issue of privacy, right? But transparency is important for, in something, righting wrongs. For instance, what an open policy on tax returns might do is to help you understand if there's a gender bias in salaries, for instance, mm-hmm. right? So by looking at tax returns, you know exactly how much people are paid, for instance. So I think there's a lot to be said for transparency in governance. It just puts everything out there and you're yep. fighting for equal pay. This is great.
Well, not just equal pay, but you know, to make sure that there's no corruption involved, right? So just
absolutely. So
the most basic of which.
Yeah. Right. So, okay. So then the corruption story comes. So Panama Papers is another occasion, has become another occasion for a discussion about transparency and tax returns and all these issues. But the question is, how do you weigh the two, right? So the argument goes that first you have to believe that both transparency and privacy, or the right to privacy, are equally important values. So to have one trump the other, you must have a really compelling argument. Not simply to have an argument, but you must have a compelling one that outweighs the other, right? Mm. So that's basically how the thought piece works. And in The Economist, it says, privacy is not purely utilitarian, but it's an important right in its on its own terms. And so that's kind of a central plank in the discussion. Now, this might not apply to many countries that are not particularly democratic or do not practice many of the kind of democratic norms associated with these kinds of ideas. But so to the extent that you are democratic and you believe this assumption, then you can proceed with the discussion. Now, what some advocates of transparency are arguing is that it creates openness that could shame individuals yep. into behaving in an appropriate way. Basically, you pay your taxes because if not, people will see that you haven't, and there's a shaming aspect to it. But and so the idea was that that would be increased revenue for governments. So this is a pragmatic argument. There'd be increased revenues for governments arising from this transparency. Now, the question is, we can look at the data to see that that's true. In countries where there's transparency, has there been, in fact, greater,
declaration of tax returns?
So the greater declaration. So the Economist points to one. They might be cherry picking here, but they look at Norway and there was a 3% increase. Now, is that significant or not? I'm not sure, but 3%. Well, depending on the base from which you're operating, is either significant or not significant.
Well, Norway has made tax returns publicly available since the early 1800s. So they've always made tax returns made public, right? So I don't know whether that's a good case
data
study.
Point.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So again, with any of these thought experiments and, you know, data-driven arguments, you have to be careful about the examples
given.
So cherry picking, right? So so Norway might not be the best example. So you probably have to go to a country where there was a severe lack of transparency, and then you had this policy shift, and then you had all this transparency. Then you see what kind of effect it has. I think the so we mentioned the question of the other kind of dividends that come from transparency, including being able to discern patterns of inequality,
yeah,
for instance.
So gender.
Yeah, so those are dividends.
Gender,
right?
Pay. Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. So these are arguments, but like we had to go back to the initial premise that these rights are so important that you just can't simply make these pragmatic arguments, or they're not as persuasive, that you have to have a really compelling argument. So basically, I mean, if you read The Economist piece, they say that, and I'm going to quote here, the case that transparency should trump privacy is not compelling. In their minds, this is The Economist, they're saying it's not compelling. Instead, they call for kind of voluntary declaration. But you look at Malaysia, right? When we've had voluntary asset declaration, I believe the Socialist Party of Malaysia's one lone parliamentarian, Dr. Michael Jayakumar of Sungai Siput, has voluntarily declared his assets. Now, did this cause a rush of asset declaration on both sides of the aisle? I don't believe so.
No.
Right. So, okay. So, is there some naivety in that, or is The Economist really looking at public perceptions in the West? They do quote one poll that suggests that most Britons want to see an openness in tax returns declarations, and so if you have that from the populace, maybe that will push people to do voluntary.
Could I make a distinction? So they're saying. So The Economist is saying. I mean, the case here is for tax returns, for everyone's tax returns to be made public. Is that right, or is it just people in elected office?
So that's the sort of subplot in this this argument, right? So they say, okay,
I've stumbled across something.
Yeah, it is. So it does. So geez, you could refine the argument further and say, well, okay, let's just let's ignore the general public. Let's protect their privacy, but let's make an exception for politicians and public and elected officials, partly because of the real serious problem of conflict of interest. And so public officials, elected officials are held to a higher standard, and therefore the question of their privacy is put into question, mm-hmm. or their right to privacy is put into question. And there again, come back to The Economist argument, they say no. They don't believe, and so they go for the voluntary declaration, because for them, privacy is such an important value, the right to privacy is such an important value, that they wouldn't give it up easily, not even for these kind of pragmatic gains. And they believe that, in fact, if there's a will to hide and to deceive the public, and people will find means. So this is not the best way of capturing deceit and fraud in public office, right? So they look to strengthening other measures rather than sacrificing the right to privacy. So
what do you think, Sharad? I mean, do you agree with The Economist's stand? I mean, I have to say, this is a publication that has described their leanings as a radical centrist. They are the radical centre, is how they describe themselves.
Well, I think, yeah. So if you go beyond their own public
editorial
relations, I think they're just, I mean, they've always been, right of centre for me. So, but I think it's important to recognize these competing values. And I think it goes back to the premise, right? What is the consensus in Malaysia, for instance? So if it applies to Malaysia, what is the consensus in Malaysia values? What is it that we do value? And when it comes to corruption, what has really been the stumbling block? Has it been issues like this, or has it been much more, structural issues and have to do with the way in which power is wielded and how power and business and the bureaucracy have fused in serious ways in this country? I think that would be, for me, the focus of an anti-corruption drive, rather than things like, I think asset declaration is interesting. I do think that even the discussion around tax return declarations, openness, or whatever, it would be interesting, but it would be insufficient. And I would like to see institutions like the MACC, get the resources, do the kind of forensics that would be necessary to really ferret out the the sophisticated forms of corruption that happen today. So, it's not just, you know, little parcels of little envelopes of money being passed under the table these days.
Yeah, it's very sophisticated. Yeah. So you're saying that you, in a small way, you do agree with the economists that, you know, there are, if you wanted to hide, there are so many ways to hide.
Yeah, but I think they're also being naive about the voluntary declaration. But I must say is that the argument is pretty nuanced because they're saying the voluntary declaration, when wedded to increase public demand for transparency and for declaration, might actually create that wave, right?
So it has to come with a kind of a public call.
Yeah, it must be. And that's the only way that politicians have the ante upped for them in terms of the democratic game, in terms of the question of transparency.
Okay. Well, my takeaway from all this is a reminder for me to file my tax returns.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.